Good morning, Imogen.
Good morning.
How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
For our listeners, let us say we are extremely lucky that we caught Imogen coming from Madrid, to host her today in this studio.
Yeah.
We saw her on performance on Saturday night, Foreign Body. And it left a big impact on me, I have to say.
Thank you.
What can you say about that particular performance, which is your... I mean, you spent quite some time to work on it and refine it.
Yeah.
And with it, you, as you said in the panel after the performance, you're opening the discussion of consent regards to our bodies.
Mm. Yeah, so Foreign Body is a play largely about my journey of healing after sexual assault, but it also includes the stories and the voices of 8 other survivors of sexual violence, and also the voice of the perpetrator of one of my assaults, who I had a kind of reconciliation process with. So the performance itself consists of those voiceover interviews, and it's a solo performance, so I'm the only person on stage. And it's a movement piece, so I just move in response to the stories that are being told on the voiceover. And it's a piece that I developed over a period of about, in total, about 5 years. And I've been now performing it for just over a year and a half, so it's been on tour in the UK. And yeah, when I began performing the play, I would have these panel discussions after the performance, usually with 1 or 2 other guests who are either survivors themselves who speak openly about their experiences, or who are working in the sector of sexual violence, in support roles generally, or campaigning. And in the beginning, I wanted to have those panels really as a space for the audience to process what they've seen and the material that they've experienced. And what I've discovered as time has gone on, or what I've come to feel, is that actually the play is almost a conduit for that conversation to happen. Mm-hmm. It was always my intention to, with the play, to do something towards destigmatizing the conversation around sexual violence, because I really feel we're only going to move away from it happening if people are able to speak openly about their experiences. That's not to say that everyone should speak openly about their experiences, because obviously it's not okay for everybody to do that. It's not safe for certain people. Some people might not have found the healing necessary to be able to have those conversations safely yet. But that's to say that we need to be having that conversation in general in society. So what I found is that, yeah, I do the performance really now in order to open that space to have that conversation. And I think that people, having experienced my performance and knowing that that's my story, feel able then to, you know, ask questions, to say things about sometimes their own experiences, but not even, you know, rarely that happens. It's really just opening the space to have a conversation about sexual violence, about all the different facets and aspects of it, and, you know, begin talking a little bit about how we can move forward.
But at least on Saturday, I didn't see much opening. I mean, it was kind of constrained a bit. Professor Ritu, she was talking about partially about something, but I still, or maybe I expected too much. I don't know. What is your, let's say, average response? Do people do open up or?
Well, like I say, it's not really my aim to encourage people to disclose their own experiences. And actually what
But also in the constructive proposals, giving the proposals how we could destigmatize any of those kind of responses.
I think I haven't had so much those responses from people in the audience, and generally what happens is people in the audience ask questions of the panel rather than suggesting. Sometimes people have suggestions to offer as well. But generally, I know that Ritu is an academic and a literary critic and a feminist. You know, she's done lots of work on feminist literature, but she's not a support worker. And quite often, and I'm not a support worker, you know, I'm a performer and I'm a campaigner, but I don't necessarily have the expertise in order to offer those solutions. But quite often what we do have on the panels are people who are experts in the sector and might have more suggestions for people in terms of how we move forward. And that's been very gratifying, really, to bring about that kind of conversation. Generally, you know, it's a limited period of time. We generally only have between half an hour and 45 minutes for that discussion. So generally we only get to take three or four questions from the audience because, you know, so it would always be wonderful to have more time. And, you know, my aim in the future, I suppose, is to have more spaces where we can then take that further and have workshops perhaps after the show. But again, I can't hold those workshops because I'm not trained, but certain people really can.
It's really sensitive topic, and it's actually the title itself does explain it, that victims might have out-of-body experiences while the, let's say, the act is happening. So it's it can trigger a lot of things, no? And it's, you need the really people who can handle that, and you need a safe space to deal with it,
Exactly.
As also on the poster, it was written, it's triggering, so be careful, I can fully understand that,
Yeah, and I'm always very careful to make sure that that's on the posters, to make sure there are announcements beforehand, to make sure that people know before they come in the space that there will be explicit descriptions of sexual violence, because as you say, if people have suffered trauma themselves, it can trigger that trauma, and I don't want to bring that about for people. They should always be in choice about whether to enter that space where these kinds of things are being discussed. And I know that, you know, people have been moved by it and possibly upset in moments, but I also, you know, part of my intention in creating the piece was to create something which is hopeful and which looks at healing and looks at coming out of, you know, the rage, the impotence, the dissociation, the denial that were places that I went through when I was healing and in my recovery process.
Humility and shame.
Yeah.
You're carrying the chair on your back, yeah?
Yeah.
But I think the pretty significant part in your play is, and it differentiates from maybe some other things we've seen on the topic, is that you include prepared theater, and is actually portrayed, and it's a true story, so it's it's a reality. It's just another man who made a mistaken judgment on certain occasion, so how does he process that? That's, I think, it's starts the dialogue, no? Somehow.
Yeah, I hope so. And there are a couple of main reasons why I included that voice. And one is to show, like you say, that he's just an ordinary person. He sounds, you know, his voice is just like an ordinary person. He's a professional man. He has friends. He has family. And it's really important that we recognize that these are the people that are perpetrating sexual violence. They're not kind of deviants who hang around on the edges of society and don't have friends and everything. They're just normal people. And as you said, they've made a bad choice. I don't think these people are inherently evil necessarily. And we have to, I think, as a society, we need to separate those two thoughts, that a perpetrator is an evil outlier. But actually, like you say, they're normal people and they made a bad choice in that moment. Because otherwise, you know, with the Me Too movement, for example, people are saying, oh, well, this man, you know, he's done campaigning around these issues, he's given money for that, he can't possibly be a perpetrator. But actually, those things sit side by side. People who do good works throughout their lives can also be perpetrators of sexual violence. It's something that
it's also misreading the situation sometimes.
Yeah,
because I know that you know, in my, somebody will look in your eyes and he will see a desire because that's what he wants, not that you want it. Per se, but they misread it. Because of what they want in the moment.
And that's why I think we have to be really rigorous about the work that we do around consent. And there's this myth perpetuated across the world, I think, and I know specifically here in India with Bollywood, and you know, that the idea that men need to pursue women and women need to act all shy, and then eventually once the man has done enough work she might say yes, and that's actually encouraging this encouraging men to push and to pursue and actually to coerce women into doing something that they don't want to do. And the assumption is in society that women are there to be coerced and men are there to do the coercing, and we have to move away from that, you know, in the tropes that we put in popular culture, in the media, you know, in film, in songs, all over the place, that women just want it and they're eventually going to say yes once you've worked hard enough, because that's really encouraging this coercion culture. And I think what we need to look for instead is enthusiastic consent. Mm-hmm. So consent shouldn't, in my view, be about she has to say no. Consent should be about the person that you want to be with, they should say yes, they should really want it, they should want to be with you. And I had saw a brilliant example of this on Twitter the other day, a woman called Dr. Nina Burrows, who's a really great follow if you're interested in this work. She campaigns brilliantly on issues of sexual violence, and she shared a little video the other day talking about consent. And she said, you know, if you turned up at someone's house, you wouldn't just barge in and then say, oh, but you didn't tell me no, you didn't tell me to stay outside. Mm. You would wait to be invited in. Mm. So why don't we have that kind of culture within sexual relations as well, that we should look for the affirmative yes, rather than, as you say, just interpreting something and barging in? Because very often, and I know in my case, I wasn't able to say no. We're often too afraid to say no. We're, as women, often in a situation where we don't have the agency to protect our own bodies. And this is another very interesting thing that's come up in the panel conversations that I've been having around India. There was one in Mumbai, where we started the tour, where the panelist, Dr. Nandita Shah, from an organisation called Akshara, which works in women's rights across the city. And she was telling a story about a taxi driver who was bringing up his children. And I know this is very common, I think, in Indian households, where the daughter would eat the leftovers from the night before, and the son would be given the fresh food each day. So the daughter then grows up with the understanding that she's less important than the brother, and that her body is worth less. So then, if you can easily translate that to her body is worthless. So if she doesn't feel that her body is worth anything, and if a man feels that his, you know, he's always been given that belief that he's more important, then he's going to push, and a woman is going to feel like they have to submit. And that's the kind of culture that we're living in, and that's dangerous, and that does not protect women, and it does not discourage.
Sex education, you can forget it. We're still struggling to get kind of routine in Orville.
Yeah.
And but it's also, they do not talk about the menstruation or like the functions of the women's body. It's like a taboo, you know. The lady in the villages, when they menstruate, they don't do chores.
Yeah,
they move away.
And also, but, you know, not that's definitely one thing. We need to be able to talk about sex before we can talk about sexual violence. Mm. We need to be able to talk about the pleasurable aspects of it. We also need to be able to talk about parts of the body. And this is what someone else was saying on the panel in Mumbai, a woman called Dr. Sangeeta Saxena from an organization called Enfold, who works specifically around child sexual violence. And she was saying how, you know, as a girl, they don't give names to the genital area. This just talked about as shame, you know, shame, shame, if a girl is naked, a child is naked. So, you know, you say heads, and this is your shoulders, and this is your chest, and this is your stomach, and then there's nothing, and then your legs and your knees. And, you know, and it's like, we need to be able to talk openly about the parts of the body and name the parts of the body in order that they know, you know, this is a part which, you know, shouldn't be touched by a stranger. And also for potential perpetrators, that these are the sacred parts of the body which you don't touch on somebody else. But if we don't name them, then we're not going to be able to have that conversation. Yeah.
You cannot even complain because you cannot make.
Yeah.
But do you think that this is coming up since we changed from matriarchat to patriarchat?
From like matriarchy to patriarchy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, gosh, that, yes.
Because institution of marriage, yeah. I don't know, cases, it's, luckily, where I come from, it's now it's legalized that the wife can sue the husband for a rape.
Right, yeah.
But I know in general terms, like in every culture, you cannot get across because you're somebody's wife.
Mm. No? Yeah. Yeah, and definitely in this country, in India, marital rape is not illegal. There's still no law to protect women within marriage. And that's obviously something which has to change. In the UK,
but that is in institution of patriarchy.
Yes, exactly.
I mean, because the man is like the one who is the most important, is the one who can do everything.
Who has a right to the body of his wife. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I mean, there are legal things in law in the UK as well, which we desperately need to change. I believe that, for example, so two of the assaults which I faced, as are described in the play, were counts of digital penetration, so penetration with the fingers rather than the genitals. And in the UK, that's not classed as rape either. In India, it is. So this is one way where I think that, you know, the Indian law around this issue is actually ahead. That any kind of penetration of the body, unwanted penetration of the body, is classed as rape with an object or with other parts of the body. In the UK, unless it's genital penetration, it doesn't count as rape. It's just molestation. And therefore, you know, I grew up believing, well, not grew up, in fact, from the moment when I was assaulted, the three separate times when I was assaulted, two of those times were digital penetration, and I thought nothing of it because I didn't know that that was assault. Mm. And it was only 12 years later, through hearing the story of somebody else, a woman in Steubenville, Ohio, it was a big news story at the time, she'd been passed out. She was digitally penetrated. People filmed it and posted it to Twitter and were bragging about it. And then she was dragged from one house to another. And the boys were eventually imprisoned. And it was only when I saw that story that I suddenly, after 12 years, remembered that I had this physical sensation, like I say in the play, this almost the sensation of something scratchy and metallic, and as I say, also a foreign body in my body.
Mm. Oh, that was the...
There are a few meanings, yeah. Okay. So the idea that that was an assault only came through that physical shadow of that memory 12 years later when I heard somebody else describing what had happened to this girl. And then the fact that these two guys were going to jail for that. That, to me, was what it took for me to understand the gravity of what had happened to me. Because when we talk about rape, we have these rape myths that, you know, someone is a stranger lurking down an alley, rather than the fact that, you know, rape can be by a partner, by someone close to you. It doesn't have to, in order to be classed as rape, it doesn't have to involve any other violence beyond the violation of that penetration itself. You know, because I think we often again associate rape with being beaten up and you know, if I'm not kicking and screaming and pushing someone off me, then it, that in many of our perceptions, then it doesn't count as rape.
Yeah, it's also the when the victims, if they dare to go to the police station, it's first they ask when you have some bruises, you didn't fight back, so you like it.
Exactly. You know, it's,
it's again a man. It's patriarchy, you know.
Yeah. I think so.
So it's, but I think that goes also beyond the sexual assault because I still believe that whoever does push you into something you don't want. I don't agree with it.
Yeah. And again, you know, this idea of teaching consent, I think we can teach consent without talking about sex. You know, you can teach it to very small children by talking about, you know, do they want a hug or do they not want a hug? Mm. Do they want to be touched on the face or do they not want to be touched
That's
on the
true,
face? Yeah. Do you want, you know, do you want to be patted on the arm or not patted on the arm? So that we instill that kind of agency in children early on. So yes, as you say, we have to learn to respect each other's bodies in general.
Yeah, because it's, or sometimes maybe somebody just want to hug you and it's like, why should I love you? If I don't feel like...
Exactly. I think we should seek consent a lot more to touch people than we actually do. You know, would you like a hug? I've got used to saying that to people now instead of just going up and grabbing them.
Mm. Yeah, but it's also a culture which thinks, oh, I believe you need the hug.
So, yeah. But you get to decide if you need that hug. You get to decide if you want it or not, right? Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah. And we should seek that consent, I think, when we touch people, because for somebody a hug might not be what they want. They might want it with someone, but not with someone else. And again, with children, you know, we have this thing at home. People always go and say, now hug, go and to a child. Now go and hug your auntie. Go and give your uncle a kiss. It's like if the child kind of squirms, no, go on. Now you're being rude. It's like, no, they're not. That child should have agency over their own body. If they don't want to hug their auntie and kiss their uncle, then they shouldn't have to. We have to teach them that it's up to them what they do with their body.
Exactly. It has to start really early on.
Yeah.
And then you can have a next generation which is already educated and in the culture that they have a right to give a consent and be respected.
No? Yeah. And then we can start by modeling that, you know, for younger people coming up. It's not just that we have to leave it only to the children, but we need to do the work now in order to model that for people who are...
How many times we do give in because somebody is just like, oh, he's expecting a hug. Even you were hugged how many times? I know for sure that you didn't want all of them, no?
No, I mean, I didn't. I guess I didn't give enthusiastic consent. But I also think there's something about... And this is important as well, I think.
That
it's much easier to read people's body language than we think, and than people might say. So during the Me Too movement in the UK, there's been all this fuss about, you know, people saying, men specifically, saying, oh, I can't even tap someone on the shoulder anymore. What's happened? You know, because people have been calling out small, you know, like if I just touched your leg in a way that you didn't like, that can be harassment, that can be assault. And so certain people are saying, oh, I can't do anything anymore, I can't give anyone a hug anymore. But actually, I think it's much easier than these people are claiming to read someone's body language. Like when you gave me a hug, if I open my arms and come towards you, that means I'm okay with being hugged. If I close my body language and move away or shield myself, then it means I don't want a hug, and I'm sure you're, you know, perceptive enough to read that in someone's body language. So it's easier than we think to read that, but it's also very easy for certain people to push that. If someone doesn't say, no, get off me, for them to go, oh, I'm just going to hug them anyway, you know, and that kind of creepy harassment, which people don't want to recognise as harassment because they see it as taking away their freedoms. Well...
No, it's not. I mean, it's just like, you know, it's also the patting the, like, the waitress on buttocks.
Yeah.
I don't, to me, that's a sexual assault.
Absolutely.
And
without question.
And somebody touching on my thigh, I'm really, you know, I'm sorry, but I don't like that.
No, without question.
Unless if somebody, I will, you know...
Yeah.
I mean, it's a completely different story, no?
Yeah, with someone that you know and you trust and you've given...
You want.
Yeah, exactly. And then we need to negotiate those situations. Like if, you know, if we're beginning a relationship and, you know, I can constantly read your signals, but I can also say, I want to touch your thigh. How does that feel for you? And if it feels great, like you're smiling and laughing... Maybe that feels good. Maybe you're smiling and laughing because you feel awkward, but I need to check that with you. Can I touch you? Would you like me to touch you? And people also have this argument by saying, oh, it's taking the fun out of sex. For me, if someone says to me, can I touch your thigh? That can be, and I get to say yes and do it like this. That can be really erotic, you know. We're robbing ourselves from having these beautiful conversations of negotiation, which can be really hot, by saying, oh, you know, it's going to take away from the moment. No, it's not. If you say to me, can I, you know, I'm not going to say it now. It's like really suggestive stuff. Great, if they want that. And then you get the opportunity to say no.
I mean, it's a whole spectrum of, you know, what we've been raised to, the cultures. I mean, it's like so many things that it's madness, no?
Yeah.
But I still think that it down it does boil to patriarchy and matriarchy. Mm.
Yeah.
And that's been going on like 7 to 10,000 years.
Yes, exactly. And I think I saw a brilliant thing recently, a quote which said, and I think it's important to make this distinction because I think hearing the word patriarchy and kind of that the patriarchy is responsible, which I completely agree with, can be very alienating for men. And what I think it's important to make the distinction of, which is to say that, and this was the quote that I saw, Me Too, again, specifically about the Me Too movement, Me Too isn't women against men. Me Too is everyone against patriarchy. And so patriarchy, for me, is a long embedded system which resides in religion and business and
family life
and
education everywhere.
Yeah, education and, you know, the defense system and the military and all of these things. You know, there are more CEOs in the world called Andrew than there are women CEOs. And more women, more CEOs called Steve. So this first number is this number of Andrews, this number of Steves, and this number of women are less than either of those. So, you know, that shows how patriarchal business is, for example. So yes, it's that system which has been in place for so long, so that everything in the world revolves around, you know, not everything, but that the main systems within the world revolve around, I think, a very outdated and, as you say, patriarchal way of doing things. Mm. And that I believe also that men carry a huge burden from the patriarchy as well, because the patriarchy says that men shouldn't express their emotions. The patriarchy says that boys shouldn't cry. The patriarchy says that men should be tough and strong. So, you know, they have this tiny stricture within which they need to express themselves. And so I think the patriarchy is harming men as much as it's harming women. So it's,
yeah, right. It's give us our roles, which we're supposed to oblige.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that we really function by that.
Exactly, yeah. And I think once we're able to break that down, then we'll all be healthier and happier and better off. And we can honour one another in our true form, the masculine and the feminine, which both can be beautiful and sensitive. And, you know, we can both learn a lot from one another, I think. And I also think that, you know, gender roles that are expected of us and particularly drilled into us as children are also outdated. And actually, once we dissociate gender from genitalia, then, you know, we have a lot more freedom as well. Yeah.
I think we're here to complement each other. So it's like the way you, how you take it.
Yeah, yeah.
But it's a process, I believe, you know, like to change thousands of years of history and change the pattern.
Yeah.
I think it started after the Second World with feminism or between two wars, and it's slowly, slowly shaping something, and slowly it's like a progressive country if you know the president or the PM is a woman and you have women working.
Yeah, that's a start,
which is
I suppose.
It's still not the reality in most of the world.
No. And I feel like, yeah, that's a start to have females at the top of politics. But at the same time, I mean, we have a female prime minister in the UK at the moment, and she's as patriarchal as the rest of them. You know, women also can carry patriarchy and, you know, try and keep other women down and not empower women. Like, she's been instrumental in taking away money from women's refuges, closing down women's refuges, cutting money from rape crisis centres. Women are being the hardest hit by the financial loss of Brexit. So she's not doing anything to support women. Just because we've got women at the top, if they are still in the throes of patriarchy, it doesn't do anything to protect the rest of the women in the country, I think.
I just remember the refugees of war in Bosnia. The collective rapes.
Yeah.
And it's just, the guys just think that they give them right to do that. And it's even in history, the book, I think this history book is written wrong because it says, okay, the man was providing and she was maintaining the children. I don't think it's really, that was how it happened.
No. No, and
because in some tribes, if you go, you see exactly that the mother was the key person deciding about the things.
You know, we've seen rape as a weapon of war much closer to here in Bangladesh, for example. In the Liberation War, there were hundreds of thousands of women who were interred in these camps, which became known as rape camps, Birongonas, these women who lived with that shame throughout their whole lives, and there are very few of them left alive now, and they're still stigmatized within their communities. They've been cast out, essentially. Even their children carry the stigma of being, you know, conceived because, out of that rape.
There's millions of children. Consequences of the war rapes.
Exactly, all over the world. It's horrific. And, you know, generally, again, when we're talking about patriarchy, these wars are the consequence of men, patriarchal systems going to war with one another, and the women are the ones that are paying the greatest price, and that's a lot.
Oh, I just remember I had another question for you, which is kind of, how did your, in your relationships, I believe you had relationships, how the men responded when you told them that you've been raped?
Well, I've actually...
Because that is the stigma. Some can handle it, some... But I, as far as I know, it's quite a lot of... most of them who cannot really handle it.
Yeah, so in fact, I was only... like I said, it took me a very long time to actually understand what had happened to me as rape and what had happened as sexual assault. So I... have only really basically been in one relationship, which is my present relationship, since I've been, as it were, out about being a survivor and since I've been making this play. And actually, the man that I'm in a relationship with now has been phenomenally supportive. And in fact, it was only, it was when, at the very beginning of our relationship, we've been together about 3.5 years, and we just started seeing each other when I started making the play. I was kind of developing another piece before that, which was still around sexual violence, but when I started making the play a bit about my story. And I was doing a lot of healing work at the time, going on workshops and kind of exploring sexuality and neo-tantra and all these things, and doing kind of body work practices and talking therapy and all of these things. So it came to a place where I was like, I need to explain to him why I'm doing all this work, that I'm not just indulging myself, and also that I was beginning to work on this play. So I was like, you know, if he's going to be with me, then I need to explain to him what's going on in my life. So it was only, I mean, probably just a matter of weeks after we'd started seeing each other, that I had to kind of come out to him and say, this is what's happened to me, and this is why I've been doing all this kind of personal development work within sexuality and stuff, so that he understood that. And also, I'm making a play about my experiences. So it was a lot for someone to take, right? That they, you know, because I do, I mean, I know, as you say, and I know other survivor activist friends of mine at home who've really struggled with finding relationships, because you say a lot of people just turn their backs on them.
Yeah, and they look at you and they said you are broken goods because somebody did it to you, and you maybe enjoying it, and you didn't... even maybe you didn't even pursue and go to the police station, whatever, but it's like the men actually react more funny than the women who are going, processing, and trying to heal themselves.
Yeah. I mean, I can really only talk about my own experience, and that was that my partner, who is my fiancé, we're going to get married, you know, and we're committed to one another, and he's extraordinary, and he's been hugely supportive of me. But I'm totally aware that that is... quite rare and is the exception, because I know the other survivor friends that I have, some of them, you know, have really struggled to find relationships and particularly to enjoy sexual relationships. And that was one of the reasons why I did all that healing work, because I needed to reclaim my own body and my own pleasure and my relationship with my body and my relationship with pleasure. And it's by no means a done deal. Like, I'm still doing that work. I'm still processing it. I still need to keep doing that work. And the two of us need to do that work together. Because I guess I don't have that automatic ability to enjoy sex in the way that I might do if I hadn't been assaulted. So it's an ongoing process. And it's something that I do think there's a huge potential for pleasure in there when we really slow down and we really communicate and we really take time. But yeah, it's not easy, and finding trust wasn't easy. And also for him, I think, you know, being not only that supportive partner, but also being alongside me in this whole process of making the play. He's come to every single version of the play. He's, you know, he's come on tour with me here, partly in order to operate the show and to do some of the stage management, but also because he's a huge support to me, and I'm not sure if I would have been able to do this without him. So, you know, there are good ones out there, but I know that it's not everyone that would be supportive in that way, yeah.
Okay, we'll conclude with that, because the time is running and you have some more pleasurable things to do.
Yeah, well, it's been a great pleasure to come and talk to you.
Imogen, thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.